All right, so are we all ready? You all have your lists?
Yes.
Well, all right, remind me who's doing what? Who's doing fantasy?
I am doing fantasy.
Okay, and then Mickey, you've got sci-fi.
Yep.
And Mark has got action. Okay.
You know what you have?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, we struggled with that topic for so we gave him sexploitation.
I'm going to figure this one out. I'm doing gorilla pictures from the 60s.
Oh, God damn it.
Well, that's Mark if there ever was
trade it up, man.
A topic.
Be sure to trade it up.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Hello there, and welcome to the Lobot Lounge. Once again, the nerds have gathered to discuss all things geekdom, all things fun, all things unusual, all things fantastic. You have joined us on a very epic evening. We are gathered together to talk about our top 10 lists. That's right, top 10 lists can cover anything from humor, the absurd, the mundane, the silly. But in this case, we are talking film genres, specifically nerd film genres, I guess you could say. We've each been assigned a specific genre of film, and we have been given 10 slots to fill, and a specific decade, the glorious 1980s.
Woo-hoo!
I know!
Radical! Wow. Totally awesome!
Dude!
Tubular!
Okay, Michelangelo.
You guys worry me.
Welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. We all have our drinks. We're going to run through these lists. Now, remember, these lists are subjective. They are our own personal lists. We don't know what the other nerds have on their lists.
That's right.
We're about to find out. We have not shared our lists with each other. We've been given this task. It's been a Herculean task, quite frankly, because paring down to 10, at first we started with 5, ladies and gentlemen, which was absolutely impossible.
Humanly impossible.
Absolutely. Sure. Ridiculous.
Preposterous.
But we have now 10, and we have 10 of the best, or the most interesting, or the most compelling, or the little gems that you may not even know exist. Isn't this exciting? Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our top 10 list. Introducing the gentleman nerds around the table is Mark Finn.
Hello, everybody.
Mickey Finn.
Hello.
Aaron DiOrive.
I'm the one that insisted the list be 10. Thank you.
And I am Joseph Otinos, your host and emotional touchstone. We all have drinks and Maximilian standing at the door, so let's get started. We have decided to go in this order: horror, fantasy, science fiction, and action. Those are the genres we are going to be covering. And our top 10 lists will begin in the realm of horror, the 1980s. For some strange reason, the gentleman nerds decided that I should cover horror.
You don't know anything about that, do you?
So, we're going to launch right into this. Now, we're each going to give ourselves a period of time to discuss our list, to list them, I guess, talk about them briefly. We won't go into too much detail because we do want to keep this under 6 hours long. But I think the gentleman will be able to insert after the list possible exclusions that they felt maybe should have been on the list, or
yep.
Question why this particular film was on the list.
Yep.
But I think that's how we're going to proceed.
And when,
so, ladies
when it comes
and
out on DVD, then there'll be a 12-hour special edition.
Yes.
That's
there
right.
You go.
That's correct.
There you go.
That's correct. All right. So let me take a drink here because I'm going to need it. Hang on. Oh, that's very tasty. Thank you, whoever's mixing that. I will start with a very unusual film. I struggled with this one because I wanted it so badly on my list. It's one of my favorite horror films from the 1980s, but it's going to take the place of something that I think most people are going to expect to hear, but they're not. Okay, enough of that. Here it is. 1981, The Fun House. Toby Hooper's The Fun House. It is a gritty, dirty, slimy little film. You could smell the cotton candy and the stale popcorn. You can smell the rancid alcohol on the breath of the people who attend this little carnival in this little small town. But it's Toby Hooper's love letter to Universal Monsters. Yes, Universal Monsters. They're everywhere in this film. Joey, the little boy at the beginning who scares his sister in the shower, is a Universal Monster fan. The mother and father are watching The Bride of Frankenstein before the kids leave. The plot is very simple, ladies and gentlemen. A young lady and her date go with another couple, and they end up spending the night in the funhouse. They say, wouldn't it be great if we snuck out on the funhouse and spent the night? Now, this is one of those pretzel carnival ride fun houses with the little cheesy pop-ups, and it's a dark ride, but there's something sinister in this fun house. There's something unusual in this fun house. It's not just it's not a supernatural thing. It's a monster. It's an actual monster. In this decade of slashers and psycho killers, This is a monster. Wayne Doba was a mime who waited on Toby Hooper at a luncheon table, and Toby Hooper just liked the way he moved and hired him on the spot to play the creature in this film. Gunter is the creature's name. We also find out some things about this creature, that his father runs the funhouse, and Gunter works the funhouse wearing a Frankenstein mask and hands, and pushes kids through in this little cart. But there's a very incestuous thing going on in this carnival where every barker in every ride, in every part of this horrible, dirty little carnival, wonderful, horrible, dirty little carnival, they're all played by the same actor. It's all Kevin Conway. And he's all playing different barkers, different hairs, different styles, different voices, but it's the same guy. So you've got to go, wait a minute now, what's going on here in this funhouse? And then they make an illusion.
Is this Kevin Conway from Grease and Babylon 5?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, who plays the barker in the funhouse? And then, of course, they do a thing with a freak show. There's a two-headed cow and a two-headed baby in the freak show, which may or may not be related. Something's going on in this funhouse. Check it out. A lot of fun. It is full of unique visual imagery and a monster, an incredible Rob Bottin designed monster. Oh, excuse me, Rick Baker designed monster. Rick Baker did this one. Very unique looking. Well, I tell you, I had that poster, that Fangoria poster from the Funhouse Monster, the creature, hanging on my wall for years because it's so unique. There's my number one pick was the Funhouse. Moving down the row, I'm going to go chronologically. And this is a film that I really wanted to include because of the magic that it gave me and how much joy it gave me. And it is Halloween 2. Now, Halloween 2. Really? Yes. Halloween 2, 1981. Not the original Halloween from the 70s. Can't include that. But Halloween 2, more of the night he came home. Michael Myers is dead. Michael Myers is shot 6 times, falls off the roof of the, falls off the balcony of the house where Laurie was babysitting, hits the ground, dead. Dead, dead, dead. He no longer is a mental patient with a sister fixation. He is now something else. And on this very dark night on Halloween in Haddonfield, Illinois, 1978, he gets up and walks. Death is walking the streets of Haddonfield now. And then the wonderful thing about this film is that the supernatural starts creeping into every aspect. Bad things happen that night. Kids are run over by cars. Other kids are biting into razor blade apples. Darkness creeps through a hospital. It's weird and it's otherworldly, and it's not just a slasher film anymore. It's something more.
No, he transcends in this movie, yeah.
He becomes something beyond just a guy with a mask and a knife.
And if you watch part one and part two together, it makes a wonderful whole story.
Yes.
It's a true sequel.
It does. And frankly, the only sequel, in my opinion, that's where the story ends. That, to me, the Michael Myers story ends with Halloween 2. Yes. My favorite part of that movie is when Donald Pleasance, as Dr. Sam Loomis, who's been running around for, both movies screaming that he's evil and he's got the devil's eyes and all this stuff, he stands and he shoots him again in the hospital. Now, the first time he shoots him, it was dark. It was upstairs. Maybe he missed. Maybe he hit him in a couple of less vital areas. Who knows? I mean, he knew he shot him, but he still had a doubt, maybe. But when in Halloween 2, when Myers comes, the Shape comes bursting through that glass door, and Dr. Loomis fires no chance of a miss this time, 5 times, bam, 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 he falls. And when he stands up again, you see a bit of sanity drain out of Donald Pleasant's face. Yeah. You see Dr. Loomis drop his gun and just stare. He can't believe he just saw him stand up. He can't believe he won't die. Laurie Strode has to drag him away because he's stunned. You know, like us, we're just like, crap, why won't he die? And oh, it's a beautiful moment. It's a beautiful moment. And, of course, the music and the same mask is used, by the way, in Halloween 2 as the original Halloween. It's set in a box under John Carpenter's bed. He pulled it out. Deborah Hill confirmed it. The exact same mask is used in Halloween 2. My next film on the list of 80s films, horror films that I highly recommend and you must see, is 1982's Creepshow. Creepshow, the most fun you will have being scared, and it is so true. You take Stephen King, prolific horror writer, one of the greatest, and then you combine him with Tom Savini, the master makeup artist and special effects guru from the 80s, and you get it all directed by George Romero. Now you've got something. And you fill this film with genre actors just chewing scenery and having fun and not giving a rat's ass how ridiculous these stories are. E.G. Marshall is Upson Pratt in the final story. They're creeping up on you. Fritz Weaver in the crate. It's fantastic. There are five stories in this, and it is done in a comic book way, like an old E.C. comics brought to life. Leslie Nielsen is in this film as well.
Is that the one where Stephen King says, meteor shit?
Yes. That's right. Stephen King himself plays Jordy Verrill in The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill. There's five tales, and they're all strung together in the with the connection of a comic book that is thrown out. A father gets upset at his son for reading this horror crap. You read this horror crap. He throws it out in the middle of the night, and in the storm that follows, the comic book is via animation tossed around the sky, and it lands in different areas, and it opens up, and it flips through, and we get to get the stories, and the creep is our host. It's a lovely film. It's a very, very enjoyable and over-the-top gore. Oh, Savini did some amazing special effects. The stories, again, are Father's Day, The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill, Something That Tied You Over, The Crate, and the Pièce de Résistance, They're Creeping Up on You.
Nice.
They're Creeping Up on You is the story that people walk out kind of stunned. They walk out numb, and they think, did I just see that? Did I just see an army of roaches kill someone? Did I just see a bloody army of roaches burst out of someone's chest and throat and mouth and cover a room? Did I just see that? Yes, you did, thanks to Tom Savini.
What's the matter, Mr. Pratt? Bugs got you, Doug.
Yes, Doug.
God.
Talk to me. Next on my list is from 1982, The Thing.
Oh, yeah.
John Carpenter's The Thing. Now, speaking of, I mentioned Rob Bottin earlier erroneously. Rob Bottin was the special effects master behind The Creature and The Thing. Now, we're talking about, stunning things that you hadn't seen before. The story briefly, of course, is a military and scientific encampment up north in the frozen wastelands, and there's an alien spaceship that's discovered. It opens with them chasing a dog. There's a Russian camp chasing down a dog.
Norwegian.
Norwegian trying to kill this dog, and they don't understand why, and ends up blowing themselves up in the process. And this dog, of course, is carrying this alien entity inside it, the thing, who can jump from body to body, who can duplicate and multiply, because it's not just one, it's multiple things. And you know, it's a little confusing at first, because you're thinking, well, if they just killed it, how's it still around? Well, the slightest bit, the slightest touch, the slightest bit of fluid or blood or slime, or who knows how it does it, but it can be in multiple places.
Yeah.
Which I found very interesting in the context of the film, where the thing is trying to get away. He's trying to leave. He's trapped.
But, you know, I always wondered about that movie. Were other things aware of each other? Like are each of them individually sentient, or do they work as a group organism? I always wondered about that.
This is the answer to that question. And there's a scene where they use defibrillators, and they're trying to bring somebody back to life who's having a heart attack. And that person who's having the heart attack
is the thing.
Now, did the thing copy that person to the point of being so perfect that he gave him a bad heart? That he copied a bad heart?
Yes.
And therefore had
he
a heart attack,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Then, as the head, the infamous scene where the head stretches off the table and in a gruesome display comes down off the table, sprouts legs and antenna, and starts scurrying away, the person who identifies it, the person who sees it, the person who calls MacReady his attention to it,
yeah, who says, you've got
is the thing, is another thing.
Yes, yes.
He's the one who says, you gotta be fucking kidding me.
Yeah.
That he was the thing too.
So I guess you're right. I think it duplicates them so perfectly.
Right.
The other question is, when
are not really aware?
Is he the thing at the time?
Yes,
yes,
he is.
Okay.
He was the thing at the time.
He was
because they tie him up later in
right
the very here next scene.
Mm-hmm.
They tie him up and he starts transforming right in the chair.
Yeah. So he called attention to
yeah
itself.
Yeah.
Maybe
that's
to throw off the scent, perhaps. Maybe
yeah
if he's gonna. Because
if only one of it escapes, then they win.
Good.
So
yeah
he can blame him. Look, there's a thing over there.
Right.
As long as he gets away.
What a unique way of looking at this film.
Yeah.
It's such a beautiful film.
One of my favorites.
Yeah,
one of my favorites.
It's so impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely one of the top, and it's not just one of the great horror films, it's one of the great American movies, period.
Yep.
The Thing, 1982, which, you know, the crazy thing was, it didn't do well. It didn't do well when it's talking about critics. And
right,
like,
when it was first released,
yeah,
it was
savage.
Yeah, it was not
and
considered.
And it was a huge disappointment.
Of course, now it's a cult classic.
Yeah,
I mean.
Yeah. But Carpenter, he was very bitter about that.
Yeah,
very. Right. And rightfully so. That was such an amazing film. What? Next up on my list. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, when you finish your list, let's put a pin in this because I have a comment as to why that was so, and we'll get back to it. But
okay. I'm going to put a pin right there. Okay, next film in 1981. I'm going to have double kind of a back-to-back 1981 films here coming up, both werewolf films, both seminal classics, An American Werewolf in London.
Oh, my God, yes.
And The Howling.
Yep.
Two very different werewolf films. Both amazing films, different styles of werewolves, two different directors, John Landis and, of course, Joe Dante, who did The Howling. John Landis tells us the story of an American in London who is bitten by a werewolf on the moors. It is passed on his curse. His best friend is mauled to death and appears to him as a rotting corpse to warn him that he is the last of the werewolf bloodline. He must sever the bloodline.
Yep.
And David Kessler is our unfortunate werewolf in American Werewolf in London, played by David Naughton. I'm a pepper, you're a pepper, he's
mm-hmm
a pepper. And he, the transformation, of course, won Rick Baker an Oscar, deservedly
the,
so.
The first Oscar ever given for special makeup effects.
Mm-hmm.
They created that category so they could give it to him.
That's right.
Oh, wait, no, is that true? I thought Exorcist won with Dick Smith.
Those have, in the past, Chambers and Dick Smith won special Oscars.
I understand. Yeah. Cool. Awesome.
Sorry, Joseph. Go ahead.
No. Please. Much deservedly so, and that's absolutely true. But when you see that transformation, you are pulled in by the fact that it hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts to transform. He screams, and you hear popping bones, and his whole physiology is changing. He transforms into a large wolf demon-like thing on 4 feet. You know, with hideous yellow eyes and a monstrous jaw, and the sound of his howl, his human scream slash howl that's haunting and echoing through the night. And you just, if you hear that, you're like, what the hell was that? It's not a man, it's not an animal. What the hell is that?
Yeah.
I mean, that sound was so effective. The Howling, on the other hand, is a very different type of werewolf film. These werewolves are very happy to be werewolves, and they take great joy in their transformations. Eddie Quist stands before one of our characters and transforms into a werewolf very slowly, and does it so she could see every little thing happening, and he smiles at her as he's transforming, and his clothes are popping off of him. They transform anytime they want to, day, night, doesn't matter. Like Dick Miller said, they're like cockroaches. You can't get rid of them, the damn things. And American Werewolf in London eschewed some of the classic trappings of werewolf films, except the fact that, you know, whoever is bitten by a werewolf becomes a werewolf. That's true, but the silver bullets, that doesn't matter. You can hang yourself, kill yourself, cut your wrist, whatever. You can just die. You can just die.
To quote Griffin Dunn, be serious, would you?
Don't have to have a silver bullet? No. But The Howling took that and clung to it. There are very definite calls out to that. In fact, The Howling, another big, big fun part about this is all the main characters are named after directors of werewolf films of the past.
Yes.
And it's a lot of fun to sit there and nitpick, and they have the Wolfman, 1941 is the Wolfman playing on TV at one point, and they Wolf Brand Chili is shown on a desk, and there's an animated wolf coming in off, attacking a little lamb. The death in the office when Eddie Quist murders I can't remember the character's name, in the office. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
He plays with her. He holds her. And the design on these creatures are standing on two legs with the wolf face, yeah, with the jaw and the ears. You know,
the bipedal
fur,
wolf, yeah.
Massive yeah. thing. And just, you know, just huge and physical.
Yeah.
But in control. And that was the part that really kind of affected me as a kid, was that this werewolf knew what it was doing very, very well. It was just, you know, the werewolf in wolf form and the werewolf in human form are the same mind.
Yeah, they maintained his human intelligence,
yeah,
which makes it, which is, the American Werewolf is sympathetic. You're sympathetic to him even though he's done horrible stuff. You
right.
are not sympathetic towards any of these werewolves.
Right.
In the Howling.
Patrick McNee is in the film. There's a whole colony of werewolves that live trying to live underneath the radar, but there are several radical werewolves that don't really want to be gentle and kind and live under the radar. They want to just tear through humans. They're our cattle. They're our food. They've always been our food. John Carradine says, "You can't tame what's wild, Doc. Just ain't natural."
Right.
And it's
yeah.
true. You cannot do it.
And then there's a were-sheepdog at the end.
And then there's a little were-sheepdog.
Yeah, or as my wife calls it, were-pickanies.
Yes.
Oh, it looks like a kind of an Ewok, too.
It does. It looks like a pickanies. It's the cutest thing.
It's adorable.
Dee Wallace, man. Yeah, Dee Wallace.
That's right. Dee Wallace. She makes a very cute werewolf.
Oh, she's awesome.
Yeah, the things they did with special effects. No, it was real. She turned into a werewolf in the shot. You're
yeah.
drunk. Doesn't mean it wasn't true. Moving on through my list, ladies and gentlemen, next one's going to be a head scratcher for many of you, and because I know many of you think I'm a rational, intelligent human being with great taste in film.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I'm going to do it. 1984, Friday the 13th, the final chapter.
What the hell?
Yep, I know what you're
wow.
thinking. How in the hell? Here's why. First of all, it's Jason Voorhees, who deserves mention in any list of 80s horror.
Sure.
Because he is
sure.
Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
He has survived the test of time. His hockey-masked face it appears to this day in model kits, posters, tattoos,
oh, yeah.
action figures, video games. He is incredibly popular. This was Jason at his height. Now, we all know that the original Friday the 13th in 1980 was Pamela Voorhees, not Jason, the mother, who was killed, beheaded,
spoiler.
On the shores of Crystal Lake. I know. And, of course, Jason takes over after that. Now, I know what these movies are, ladies and gentlemen. I do know that they are crap. I do know that they are absolute crap, but they're fun. Nothing can replace the feeling of being in a movie theater, in a packed movie theater in 1984, as I was, with people watching Friday the 13th, the final chapter, screaming in terror, laughing, so much energy, the joy of watching what's going on. I'll tell you a quick story about my watching of Friday the 13th, the final chapter, and I picked the final chapter because it's Jason at his most brutal. Tom Savini did the special effects in the original Friday the 13th and was called back to do the quote-unquote final chapter. Because, yes, honestly, Jason Voorhees does die in this film. He does indeed die. He is killed. He is dead. Gone. In fact, so dead and gone that the very next movie, Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning, did not feature Jason Voorhees at all, but a pseudo-Jason, a copycat killer. Jason Voorhees took a year off to rot into the ground. He didn't come back until part 6.
Yep.
He was dead, folks. This is a big deal. And he was Ted White, uncredited Ted White, played Jason Voorhees in this film, and he's just a huge hulking monster. There's just no subtlety to this Jason. One of my favorite memories of watching this film is being in that crowded theater and people cheering. When Jason comes back, you know, they think he's dead, and they put him in a morgue, but he gets back up again, of course. And he kills Axel, the morgue attendant, and the nurse. He takes a hacksaw, and he drags it across his throat in a gorish, blood-spattering, noisy way, and then twists the head around all the way. And audience goes crazy, yeah! And it's like, yes, this is a blood... These people want blood. They're all excited. Yes. And he stabs the nurse and he just eviscerates her, dragging that scalpel slowly up her body. And she's screaming, you and the screams and the blood. And the audience is like, yeah. And I'm just like, yeah. Third murder in the film is a hitchhiker sitting on the side of the road eating a banana. For some reason, Jason was pissed off or something. Walked up behind her, grabbed her by the head, shoved a blade through her throat. Banana and blood comes spurting out of her mouth. The audience goes crazy. Yeah. Oh, I'm in it, man. This is fun. We're having a good old time. Fourth murder. beautiful naked girl swims out in the middle of a dark lake, jumps into a raft. Jason jumps out from underneath the water, stabs her from underneath the raft. As the blade's coming through her back, she's gasping and screaming in blood. And I'm the only one in the theater going, yeah! What happened? They turned, and suddenly it was all about, damn you, Jason, you went too far. So then every time Jason got hit, the audience would go crazy, and yeah, get him, you know? Oh, it was so much fun. These movies are great. And finally, on Friday the 13th, the final chapter, director Joseph Zito does something that no other Friday the 13th director has done. He puts in a very, very creepy moment. At the very beginning of the film, it's the cleanup from part three. There's an ambulance, there's police helicopters, they're taking bodies away, that's what they did. And they all leave this little camp area, the flashing lights, the ambulances, the police cars, the helicopter, the searchlight, it all just goes away. And Joseph Zito just stays there. And he lets all the sound go dimly away, and then you start hearing crickets again. And night, and it sits in this dark camp for a little longer than it should until you're kind of uncomfortable, and then it cuts to the next scene. It's a brilliant piece. That right there to me is a standout and why I picked this one film out of all the Friday the 13th films.
Okay.
So how long is this episode going to be?
Sorry. Working on it. Okay, moving on. Our next film, 1984, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven's introduction of Fred Krueger. It cannot be denied as one of the most important moments in horror history. Here we have Robert Englund playing wisecracking dream demon Fred Krueger, killing people in their dreams, punishing the children for the sins of the parents.
And another iconic slasher.
Absolutely.
And a beautifully designed film.
It really is.
The first one, yeah.
It works so well. I mean, before he became the Ronald McDonald of horror, Freddy Krueger was a terrifying thing in the dark. You didn't know what the hell you were looking at.
Yeah.
You can't even go to sleep without being attacked. The sins of the father. I mean, where can you hide? You can't hide. You go to sleep. This is Wes Craven's bread and butter. I mean, he understood this better than anyone else.
Yeah.
And about guilt and blame. And you can't reckon with the ghosts when they come back looking for payback, especially when you didn't do anything. It's terrifying, and it's a wonderful, wonderful film. Wrapping up my last two from 1985, Reanimator. Stuart Gordon's Reanimator.
Herbert.
Herbert West. That's Jeffrey Combs as Herbert West, an H.P. Lovecraft story of a scientist who experiments with the dead and brings them back to life with his reagent with horrible consequences. But it's Jeffrey Combs as Herbert West that needs to be pointed out here. The special effects are wildly over the top. The film was rated unrated. It was at least unrated. So people would come to the theater to buy these tickets, and I worked at the theater, and I'm sorry you can't see it. Well, he's with me. He's my son. I'm sorry he can't see it. It's no one under 18 admitted, period,
right,
to this film. Yes, you're seeing a decapitated head going down on a woman tied to a table. You're not seeing this anywhere else. It's one of those. You know, how do you quantify that, right? You're not even a second-rate scientist. Get a job in a science. Great film, though. Great film. Reanimator. Oh, yeah. Final film of the night, for me at least, is 1985's Fright Night.
Yes.
It's did for vampires what the American Werewolf and the Howling did for werewolves in the decade. Jerry Dandridge is the vampire who moves into a little suburban neighborhood next door to Charlie Brewster, who sees things that makes him doubt and wonder and suspect, and he starts putting things together, but then nobody believes him, but the vampire knows that he knows, and that's the horror. There's moments where Jerry Dandridge shows up in his house, because first he thought, I'm safe. The vampire can't come into my house without being invited by the rightful owner. He comes home and his mom's invited the neighbor over for drinks. And oh my God, here he is in my house.
That is the best scene in the movie.
It really
is.
And he shakes his hand and he says, oh, Charlie, I'll see you soon.
Yeah.
You
know? What's the matter, Charlie? Afraid I wouldn't come over without being invited first?
Yeah.
You're right, of course. But now that I've been made to feel welcome, I'll be stopping by quite a bit. In fact, anytime I feel like it.
Yeah.
With your mother's kind permission.
The best thing ever.
I know. Yeah. It's just some of the best freaking lines in that movie.
He shows up that night, and he tries to give him a chance. Forget about me, Charlie. Forget about me, and I'll forget about you.
And I would have taken that deal in a heartbeat. FYI.
At the very least, lie to him and say, sure, I'll take that deal, and then try to find a way to deal with it.
16-year-old Mark would have been like, where do I sign?
Yeah.
And hey, Billy Cole's kind of old. I think I could do his job better than him.
That's right.
I will be a better ghoul to you than your current ghoul.
I love that. And such a great, unique relationship between the two. There's great moments in that film just everywhere. One of my favorites, when Peter Vincent, of course, played by the great Roddy McDowall, a horror host, TV horror host, who's recruited by Charlie Brewster to help him fight this vampire. They're in the house. They see what Dandridge has bitten Amy, the girlfriend, and is transforming her into a vampire. He's upstairs with Charlie, and he says, oh, my God. And they cut down to the basement where Dandridge and Cole are there transferring dirt from his coffin to Amy's coffin. And he stops and looks up because he heard the word God the house.
Yeah.
Things like that are just... so well done.
It's very well done.
Fright Night. Okay, so summary. The Funhouse, Halloween 2, Creepshow, The Thing, American Werewolf in London, The Howling, Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, I don't care, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Reanimator, and Fright Night.
Nice.
Gentlemen,
that's a respectable list.
I yield the floor.
That is a respectable list. I'm just going to very quickly add... some of my favorite horror movies from the 80s that people absolutely must see. One is The Changeling with George C. Scott, which is an absolutely wonderfully terrifying ghost story with an incredibly sympathetic ghost.
Mm-hmm.
The second is Cat People, which, whereas I don't think it is as good as the original Cat People, which is a fantastic film. Nastasia Kinski running around naked, turning into a panther. There's just nothing not to love about this movie, with, of course, Malcolm McDowell playing the villain, her brother. And then very quickly, The Hunger, which is a fantastic vampire film, a very good take on vampire films.
Yes.
The novel by Whitley Strieber is actually very interesting, and they are not vampires in the way that we understand them. So if you've not read the novel by Whitley Strieber, you should. And then finally, I'll finish it out with The Company of Wolves.
Nice.
Yes.
Which is just a fantastic, again, it's another anthology piece that tells different stories about werewolves. But it is just, it's beautiful. It's a beautifully done, by Neil Jordan, a beautifully done film. So those are my quick additions.
Porcelain grandmother heads.
Yeah.
Guys, do you have anything to add?
Go ahead. Mickey, you got anything?
It's actually was filmed in the 80s, but wasn't released until 1990. Mr. Frost with Jeff Goldblum. It's still very much an 80s film. Basically, you've got Jeff Goldblum as a patient locked up in the insane asylum because he murdered a bunch of people and claims he's the devil.
Yeah.
And him getting inside of the psychiatrist's head back and forth, it way outdoes Hannibal Lecter. And it's a very good film. And also, I've got a trivia question for you.
Okay.
Now, The Thing, John Carpenter's The Thing, because he has to put his name on everything like that, is an adaptation of the classic science fiction novella, Who Goes There?
Who Goes There?
By John W. Campbell.
Right.
Was first remade, or was first made into a movie with a giant carrot in the 50s.
Yeah.
Yes.
Directed by Howard Hawks.
And was not a shapeshifter, and that's where the Thing title comes from. And then, of course, John Carpenter redid the original story quite closely. There was a third adaptation about it.
A third adaptation of The Thing?
Are you talking about the prequel?
No.
The remake or the prequel?
No,
yeah,
there was a third adaptation, not of The Thing, but of Who Goes,
Who Goes There.
Oh.
And it's right up your ballywick.
Okay. I'm not familiar with it. What is it?
Horror Express.
Oh!
Horror Express. Okay.
I get it.
Yeah,
but
it was inspired by the novella.
Was it?
Yep.
Okay, so it literally is not an interpretation. It's just loosely inspired by.
Yes.
Okay, but it is considered one of the three remakes of that story.
Interesting.
That's interesting.
Right.
That's interesting.
Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
We were just talking about this.
I have this sitting on my desk right now.
Awesome.
Is a DVD case, Horror Express.
I may have to borrow that from you because I've never.
Sure. Yeah, prior to beginning the recording, Joseph asked, "So have you seen this?" I'm like, "Oh yes, yes."
All right.
Moving on
to our next.
Well,
hold on, Mark has.
Oh, that's right.
Just two. 1987 Prince of Darkness.
Oh,
one of the scariest movies I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go ahead and go obscure. Little Jim, also from 1987, from Australia, called The Kindred. The tag on this was, Anthony is not your average bottle baby. And it's got Rod Steiger in it and Kim Hunter, and it was directed by, I forget who the director was. It's got some really sparse but effective stop-motion animation in it. It's Amanda Pays, Tina McGee from The Flash is in it, and it's a wonderful little B-grade horror film with a monster of Lovecraftian overtones.
So they
managed to do a Lovecraft story without getting into the cosmic stuff. So
I love how Amanda Pays is from a modern comic TV show and not from Max Headroom.
Nobody would know what that is.
I know, that's why it's funny.
When you say Dr. McGee from The Flash, that could be from two different shows.
Yeah, right.
Speaking of Lovecraft, I'm pretty sure, I'm not completely positive, but the guy, Dan O'Bannon, the guy behind Alien... did a Lovecraftian movie, The Curious Case of Charles Dexter Ward, and I can never remember the name the movie was assigned.
The Resurrected.
The Resurrected.
Yeah,
I love that.
In fact, the guy who stars in Fright Night.
Chris Sarandon.
Chris Sarandon. Which is really good, by the way. That is an underappreciated Lovecraft movie. It's actually really genuinely creepy.
The Haunted Palace is another adaptation of the same story with Vincent Price.
That is correct, and I like that one as well.
Charles Dexter Ward.
All right. So who's next? Me?
You are next, Aaron, for the genre of fantasy.
Here are my top 10 fantasy picks. It was tough to get it even just down to 10. We were supposed to do 5, folks, and that was just absolutely... It is cruel and unusual punishment, and so we decided that's just...
I'm having problems with 10.
All right, so my number one from 1981, and the reason I picked this one, it was because the last movie that Ray Harryhausen did the effects for, it is Clash of the Titans.
Nice.
So I had to include Ray Harryhausen's final goodbye film, which I enjoyed very much. I actually like the remakes. The remake Clash of the Titans and Wrath of the Titans are actually, I think, underappreciated fantasy films, and people should check them out. But, Clash of the Titans, had to do it. That's my number one. Well, on my list. Number two, Dragon Slayer, 1981 also. And again, simply because of the spectacular effects of the dragon, Vermithrax, and how she moved and all that kind of stuff. I mean, overall, it's not one of my favorite movies, as in it is so slowly paced. It is a cure for insomnia at certain points, but on the parts that have action, they are exceptional, and it's a really fantastic film. And I think the relationship between the wizard and his apprentice is absolutely beautifully done. I love the old wizard that knows his time is coming. Magic is leaving the world, and it's a wonderful film about that. What happens when magic begins to die from the world? Which is that theme runs throughout the entire movie. Very well done.
And there's a great way of doing cultural whiplash by watching that movie and then watching Ally McBeal, because
Peter
May Nichol, right?
It's the same actor.
Yeah. Okay. Also from 1981. I have lots from 1981, by the way. Excalibur. I mean, God, who does not love X freaking Calibur? First of all, it was one of my first. The first time I was aware of Helen Mirren as an actress, and of course she's running around in that skimpy outfit as Morgana, and I'm just like, oh my God, this woman is beautiful, she's mesmerizing, she's bewitching, who is she? And of course she's still around and still just as beautiful and sexy. Very well done, a very well done movie, about the King Arthur myth, and the sword Excalibur. And in fact, the young Laughing Mordred, who was the son of the director, Borman, he was also in Emerald Forest, playing the son in another Borman movie. But so, number three, Excalibur. Number four from 1982, Conan the Barbarian. I would be remiss, Mark would have beat me up if I had not included Conan the Barbarian. And again, Conan the Barbarian is for me, again, a very mixed bag. There are moments that just don't quite work for me. And then there are moments that are simply brilliant. The attack on the temple, the final battle. There's just some really, really wonderful moments in that movie. I would say that Arnold Schwarzenegger makes the best looking Conan, but he actually has not been my favorite Conan.
No.
That honor goes to, believe it or not, Jason Momoa.
Yes.
From the last Conan movie that we had, which, again, I liked even less than the original Conan the Barbarian, but not because of Jason Momoa. Jason Momoa nailed the character, and I really wish they would make another movie with a good script this time and put Jason Momoa in it, because that is Conan the Thief, that is Conan the Raver, that is Conan. He's got the swagger, the look, the scowl. It's fantastic. All right, number five, from 1982 as well, The Dark Crystal. Love this movie. I cannot praise this movie enough. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but the world that Henson managed to create without a single bit of CGI, it is all practical effects, sets, costumes, puppets. It's amazing. You watch it today, and it holds up. It is a beautifully realized world. And more than anything, I admire it for that. The design, the production design, the design of the Skeksis and the architecture. There was a book that came out called The Book of the Dark Crystal, and it is nothing but all of the concepts of from the movie, the drawings by by Brian Froud. I mean, it's just gorgeous stuff. So Dark Crystal had to be in there. All right, so number six, I chose this one because I actually saw this in the 80s, and it was my introduction to the world of Miyazaki, and it's Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. It's one of the first times, it was in 1984, one of the first times I became aware of that entire genre of anime, and especially of specifically Miyazaki's worlds. It is again, Miyazaki is a master at creating a setting and making it seem real, lived in. You can believe that this was someplace, somewhere. And Nausicaä is my introduction to that. And I think a lot of Americans' introduction to Miyazaki's world was in through Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. So 1985, we have, of course, Legend. How can I not include Legend?
I'll show you how.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, no. Legend is a
beautiful music video.
No. It is. Again, it is not everybody's cup of tea, but it is just so wonderfully fantastical in so many of its elements, and it's fun to watch. There's two different cuts of Legend. One is the theatrical American cut that most people are familiar with. And they later came out with an extended European cut where they removed the soundtrack by Tangerine Dream and put the original soundtrack by Jerry Goldsmith. Whereas I don't prefer the Jerry Goldsmith soundtrack, I do prefer the extended cut. We see a lot more interactions between Jack and Gump. We see more interactions in that wonderful scene with Robert Picardo, speaking about the Howling.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Picardo is the Meg Knucklebones, and she comes out of the water, and, foul-tasting fairy! And she has this long exchange with Tom Cruise.
Great-looking creature.
Oh, she's fantastic. Yeah. And again, the entire design of that movie, the goblin, played by Alice Playton, Blix, was specifically designed to look like... And, was it Botine? I think it was Botine. Designed to look like
Keith Richards.
Yes, Keith Richards. When he first put the makeup on the actress, and she looked at herself in the mirror, and he was waiting, and she's like, "This reminds me of something." And he's like, "Keith Richards, right?" She's like, "Oh my God, yes!" She's like, "Yep, and you look like Keith Richards. I made the goblin look like Keith Richards." So anyway, wonderful film. I love it. I we watch it again every couple years or so. Another one from 1985, which I'm going to lump in with Legend because I really just see them as indistinguishable, Lady Hawk. I actually, again, I'm not a big fan of Lady Hawk. I like a lot of what they did in the movie, but those two came out so closely together that I remember people were talking both about Legend and about Lady Hawk at around the same time. So again, that's why I see those as a two for one kind of thing. So 1986, Big Trouble in Little China, and I have to put that in there, even though I do think that is more of an action adventure, which Mark might touch on. But I put it in there because it is, in my opinion, a big introduction to American audiences of Hong Kong cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, in 1986, you could see, you know, Hong Kong movies, Shaw Brother movies, when you would go to, you know, little art house theaters or old theaters down on, in the case of Austin, down off of Ben White or such, where they have Hong Kong night. But this was really the introduction. This was before Jackie Chan started becoming very popular, and Jet Li and all these other Hong Kong action stars. I think the introduction was, the taste for it, was put there by Big Trouble in Little China.
And it was one of the original urban fantasy stories.
Yes, absolutely. And again, just so much love about that movie. Mm. So much love about that movie. So, 1987, The Princess Bride. My wife would have killed me if I didn't put The Princess Bride on there. Her and my daughter love The Princess Bride, and with good reason. It's beautifully directed, beautifully acted, wonderfully written, based on a William Goldman novel. And I just can't say enough good things about The Princess Bride. One of my favorites. You need to watch it. And then finally, I'll close it out in 1988 with Willow. And again, just as one of those definitive fantasy movies.
Is that 11?
I did a 2-for-1. On the Lady Hawk.
Oh, okay. I'm keeping track. You wait, that's 11.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
two for one on Legend and Lady Hawk.
Okay.
But Willow I include in there because Willow was Lord of the Rings before we had Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1888, they thought, well, the audience is hungry for a big epic fantasy. It turns out they weren't quite ready for it, and it would take another couple of decades before we got the Lord of the Rings. But I think that was the first Hollywood sort of dipping its toe into the waters of do they want to see a long form narrative like the Lord of the Rings? And that was Willow. Of course, it was supposed to be a sequel. There never was. But yeah, I'm very fond of the movie. So anyway, so that is my top 10 80s fantasy movies.
And I'm going to have to jump in there with at least two.
Okay, Clash of the Titans, Dragon Slayer, Excalibur, Conan the Barbarian, The Dark Crystal, Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, The 2-for-1, Legend/Lady Hawk, Big Trouble in Little China, The Princess Bride, and Willow.
Excellent, excellent. Just one film that I would have loved to hear on that list, just because it's a secret pleasure shame of mine, is The Sword and the Sorcerer. Cheesy 1980s fantasy film. That's all I can say. Richard Mall is the sorcerer in that film.
I almost included it, but I knew you guys would mention it.
Yeah, it's really over the top. But there's, you know, cannibal creatures and a sword that fires, a three-bladed sword that fires.
Yeah,
that,
the most ridiculous sword.
But that was just a lot of fun. That's my one entry in there.
We got people right now yelling at the podcast going, I can't believe you left Labyrinth off.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
I can't believe
again.
You left Highlander off.
I knew one of you guys would cover it. I knew it.
You left off Deathstalker 2.
Oh, Jesus.
Yes. Now we're talking.
Wow.
We're Fighting Eagle.
Wow.
No, I'm not. I was purposely ignoring Barbarian Brothers and Ator the Fighting Eagle and all that.
Hawk the Slayer?
Hawk the Slayer. Yeah. No, never.
I'm kind of surprised that Krull wasn't on there.
You know, I wanted to put Krull on there, and as you know, I just recently saw that with my daughter. I showed it to her, and I turned to her at one point, about a third away from the movie. What do you think, honey? And she was asleep.
Yeah, buddy.
So that basically was what decided me not to put it on my list. Yeah.
Well, let me toss a couple out that I think need to be on a top 10 fantasy list is The Beastmaster, Don Coscarelli's. Okay. Sword and Sorcery masterpiece.
Yeah.
I would also in the cheap thrills category, I think this works best if you turn the whole sound off. Fire and Ice.
Oh yeah.
The rotoscope animated Ralph Bakshi animated thing with Frank Frazetta designed characters is one of the most gorgeously animated and certainly pre-computer generated years, one of the only ways to get really visceral combat where the subhuman is jumping in midair and Dark Wolf swings his axe around and catches him in midair and doesn't just catch him but like stops the lunge and pitches him backward, you know, because you can do cartoon physics in cartoons.
Right.
The story is the most, it's pablum, it is trite, and but if you say to have a few beers and put this on and then put the sound down and turn on the soundtrack to Conan the Barbarian. This movie kicks ass.
I love that scene with Necron when he kills all the assassins and that he freezes them all and he makes them all stab themselves or stab each other. It's a really nice, creepy moment.
But and again, like Conan, by the way, Fire and Ice has certain moments that are absolute surefire cures for insomnia. But you know, again, most of the movies I think that we are talking about have those moments where it's like, well, I could cut this entire 15-minute sequence out and nobody would notice. But I agree, Fire and Ice. Again, I knew you guys would include Sword of the Sorcerer. Yeah. I knew you would include Beastmaster. I knew somebody would talk about Fire and Ice. That's why I have you guys.
For animated fantasy, would you include Wizards in that?
That's 70s.
Or was that sci-fi?
I put that more 70s. Sci-fi. And
is that, was that 70s?
Yeah. Yeah, late 70s.
Okay. All right. Well, moving on then.
Speaking of sci-fi.
Mickey Finn.
Okay, well, first the Starman. No, seriously. Okay, first of all, we cannot list Empire Strikes Back.
What?
Because we're at the Lobot Lounge, and there's a conflict of interest there.
Gotcha.
Yes. And was the black hole in the 80s or 70s?
It's 1980.
Yeah, it's 1980.
Okay, we can't include that either because of our bouncer.
He's looking at us, actually. Do not.
So,
all
course,
good, buddy.
The first obvious one would be Blade Runner.
Ah,
sure.
Yep.
Just as a general film, it is classic noir.
Yep.
It is classic science fiction in both look and in message. Beautifully immersive.
I defy anybody to name a movie that's been more influential on the look of movies after it than Blade Runner.
And I mean, you know, of course, Blade Runner bombed, you know.
Yeah.
Like a at the time. Day-glow bomber.
We'll get back to that. I'll cover that.
Yeah.
We've got two versions. We have the director's cut with no narration. We have the original version with the narration. I'm one of the few people who actually prefers the narration because it...
As do I.
Yeah, it adds something to Deckard's... I mean, his dry delivery of it...
More film noir.
...wound up enhancing the character. And then the next one after that would be Aliens.
Sure.
Aliens?
Aliens. Okay. Because Alien...
That's definitely sci-fi. 70.
Sci-fi. All right.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Aliens, because what we've got is between Blade Runner and Aliens, we've pretty much cemented the idea that you can have fully immersive science fiction that completely draws you into the world. Blade Runner, stuck on Earth. Aliens goes out into space. Action ride with a good story, good everything laid out, great special effects. It's just, it's a classic for a reason.
Yep.
Terminator, which would be Cameron's first real effort, you know, outside of things like Piranha, what was it, Piranha 2, The Spawning?
Piranha 2, yeah. We don't count that.
Yeah, Terminator is, especially the extended edition, is a wonderful introduction to how time travel stories work.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, I don't know if you would say some great acting. It's got some solid character delivery.
It has acting.
Yeah.
It has acting.
Michael Biehn's in it. Michael Biehn isn't bad.
No, it is what it is.
Yeah.
He's definitely better than his replacement in the more modern version. There's some great stuff going on there with the music and some filming angles. And it firmly established James Cameron as a wonderful master of being able to take other people's stories and making them his own.
Special thanks to Harlan Ellison.
Then, yes. Hello, Uncle Harlan. And we'll follow that with a completely different direction, Bill and Ted.
Nice.
Wow.
Another time travel movie that shows the beautiful things that you can do with time travel, even if they kind of go off the rails and get a bit silly with it.
They're talking about Bill and Ted's excellent adventure, not bogus journey.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Or Bill and Ted Go to Hell.
Right.
For those who don't know, that was the original title before they changed it to Bogus Journey.
Ugh. God.
And then we'll go back into the more serious with Predator, which may very well show up on Mark's list as well, because it is primarily an action movie about hunters and the hunted. And there is surprisingly a lot of people I run across who's never seen the original Predator movie. And the tone of the original Predator, while it is not so dramatically different from the rest of the Predator franchise, it is its own thing, and it is the best version out there until Shane Black redoes it.
Yeah, I am very curious to see what Shane does.
Yeah. And then we'll get a little less grim and go into The Last Starfighter.
Okay.
For a variety of reasons. Yes, it's goofy, but it's also reminding people that science fiction can be uplifting and a grand adventure without the darkness in it. It, for the time period, it had good special effects and was one of the first examples of being able to actually use CGI in film.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And to go low-tech, we've got The Road Warrior, Mad Max 2.
Always.
Yes.
I am humongous.
The great Lord Humongous.
The Thing gets an honorable mention due to the fact that it is actually a science fiction story, but we've already talked about that.
Yep.
When it comes to sarcasm and satire, we have RoboCop.
Oh, yep. That's a brilliant film.
It is
a brilliant film.
Beautifully done all the way around.
Yes.
From special effects to acting, believe it or not.
Oh, it's good stuff. Yeah,
Peter Weller put a lot into that, into playing deadpan robotic.
Yeah.
He studied with opera masters on how to move and everything. Another little classic gem is called The Hidden.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
A lot of people have seen this. It's sort of a cross between Invasion of the Body Snatchers and I would say a Terminator film, although it's actually a cop chasing a criminal. And the criminal basically can hop in and out of bodies.
Very much like The Thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little Kyle MacLachlan film. He's perfect for the role. Playing an FBI agent, basically hunting something that he knows is an alien and nobody else does. Mm-hmm. It's also the first appearance of Claudia Christian. And there's a little trick that all the actors playing the infected got together. There's one scene in there where it gets into a dog. They were all trying to figure out something that all the actors could do to show a little personality quirk to show you that the creature was in it without any dialogue. Oh. And they settled on licking the lips because that was the only thing the dog could do. And since the creature is greedy and gluttonous, as far as, you know, appetites, not necessarily food, but, you know, just appetites for everything, it seemed apropos.
Yeah, nice.
And then I'm going to get laughed off for this last one.
I don't know.
You guys won't want to speak to me anymore.
No, I don't know. I already feel that way.
Oh, okay.
I brought up Final Chapter. It's all
yeah, right. Okay, that's true.
Can't be worse than that.
Time Rider.
Okay.
No.
Okay, yeah, you're right. No. Goodbye. Okay, folks, let's just all say goodbye to Mickey. No, I'm kidding.
Time Rider, okay.
Time Rider, wow. Adventures of Kyle Swan.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
I
actually don't even think, I don't think I've seen it.
No, most people haven't.
I've seen it.
Okay. Mark, I've seen it.
It's not a good thing. Again, what it is it shows what you can do with crossing science fiction with pretty much any genre. It is a movie that honestly tries and just kind of falls flat based on two simple concepts. One is sending a motorcycle guy back into the Old West.
Okay.
And the other concept is we're going to have a twist ending by having a grandfather paradox.
Okay.
Interesting.
All right.
Interesting.
Before anybody outside of reading science fiction knew what a grandfather complex was, so it actually was a twist at the time.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
So it's on the list because of what it was going for, not necessarily how good it is.
Well, I have to admit, I am very surprised. That is not at all what I would have expected you to pick. But it is a fascinating glimpse into Mickey Finn.
It is indeed.
So I love that. Well, let me quickly throw out Flash Gordon because Flash Gordon. Oh. Enough said.
Oh.
My God, if you do not like Flash Gordon, why are we friends?
I don't know, but I'll tell you, I don't like Flash Gordon.
Stop talking while I'm still wanting to talk to you.
I will say that I tried to rewatch it a while back. My wife owns a copy, and she will never watch it. And I'm like, it's your copy. It's the special edition.
No,
why don't you watch it?
Make no mistake. I'm not claiming it is a good movie. I am smart enough not to claim that it is a good movie, but... Wow, it is okay. Anyway, we're going to skip that one. All right, so Flash Gordon, Dune, because come on, Dune. So you should feel better about your choices, Mickey, because I'm picking Flash Gordon.
Well, Dune was on the 20 list that I had to cut down to 10.
Gotcha. And then last but not least, Brazil. Okay.
Brazil was also on there.
Yeah, those are my additions.
I will throw out, now, I could be wrong, because it might be 70s, but I thought it was early 80s, Battle Beyond the Stars?
That's early 80s.
That's early 80s, yep. The remake of The Magnificent Seven, but yep. In space, a lot of fun there. And I'm going animated, Heavy Metal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Heavy Metal.
Yep, Heavy Metal,
at least
absolutely.
Chunks of it.
Yeah. All right, I'm really surprised that you didn't mention Star Trek 2 and 4. I mean, those are quintessentially 80s movies, I fear.
Yeah,
they are.
Well, 2 is also important because we wouldn't have the Star Trek explosion that we had without 2.
Right.
Yeah, it really did. And the other one is another quirky favorite, Trancers. Starring Tim Thomerson.
Yeah,
I've never actually seen Trancers.
Oh,
really?
It's sublime. It is sublime.
Oh, hey Mark, what about Outland? Come on.
I was gonna mention Outland as well. Outland is right there at the edge of it. Sean Connery. It's basically High Noon in space, but it is Marvy Poo.
With science that looks real and isn't.
Right.
But another thing that I'm surprised that didn't come up in Joseph's list that I actually was going to add to mine and wasn't room was The Fly.
Yeah. Oh, The Fly.
The Fly. It's a great flip.
That's another quintessential 80s movie, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, mostly for Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum, being Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum. I want to start my list off calling out a couple of things that have been mentioned already. There's certain films have some things in common here, and we're going to get to them on mine. Let's see, where's the horror list? Specifically, The Thing, American Werewolf in London, The Howling, Fright Night, Dragon Slayer, and Predator, which is on my list, and we'll talk about. These are movies. They don't end in a traditional way. They end on a down note. They end sort of anticlimactically in some places, and this is all part of a larger thing that was happening in the 80s, which was where it was a reaction to the realistic filmmaking of the 70s. Okay, these guys were doing these realistic takes on things, which is why all of the film is gritty and grainy in the 1970s, and they started using lens flares in the 1970s. And as we moved into the 80s, these guys who were doing this were wanting to expand and do science fiction and fantasy and horror, but they come up in this sort of, this is the current school of thought. And so when you get to the 80s and the action adventure movies, certain things start to develop. And this is really the beginning of postmodernism in film as we understand it. I'm going to do mine in reverse order from 10 to 1. So number 10 is a Walter Hill film, Streets of Fire.
Oh yes.
This is one of those, this is very much in its 80s-ness, you know. Mm-hmm. It's called A Rock and Roll Fable. And it's kind of interesting that Walter Hill, who was known for doing real gritty action-oriented stuff in the style of Sam Peckinpah, this was like the biggest film he'd ever done at the time. It was a huge production. Michael Pare's in it. An 18-year-old Diane Lane. And Rick Moranis in one of his smarmiest roles ever. A huge rock and roll soundtrack. That song, I Can
Willem
Dream
Dafoe.
About You.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe was the bad guy. If you heard it, if you
Jim
ever
Steinem listened, did the soundtrack.
He did some of the songs on the soundtrack.
Some of the songs.
And I have a problem with Jim Steinem that goes way deeper than we have time for this podcast. I just feel like he should have never gone into rock and roll and just tried his hand at Broadway, because that's clearly where he wants to be. He's needlessly clever. Number 9 is one of my all-time favorite films, Escape from New York, directed by John Carpenter, who has been all over this everybody's list.
Yes,
tonight.
No and, kidding, man.
Snake Plissken is a true anti-hero, and this ending is a true anti-ending. Most of the guys who were directing at this point grew up watching Twilight Zone and reading EC Comics, and so this twist ending, this screw you, and especially, you know, for stuff that like means, oh, it's the fate of the free world, oh, it's it means we're going back to World War II again. You know, it's that kind of stuff. It doesn't have a lot of production values, but the character of Snake Plissken is very compelling, and the way that it's filmed and the message behind what's going on is great. It's also got an all-star cast from Ernest Borgnine on down. So it's another example of John Carpenter working with these great actors and getting really good performances out of
it. You are the Duke of New York.
That's right. Donald Pleasence is the president. Isaac Hayes is the Duke. Can I get a witness? You know? number eight, Beverly Hills Cop.
Nice.
Also, yes, very much of the Walter Hill flavored films. This was his sort of sequel to. This wasn't Hill, but this was the sequel to 48 Hours. Basically, it was Eddie Murphy on the rise. In this case, they tried him with Nick Nolte and found that everybody liked the Eddie Murphy parts best. So let's just do Eddie Murphy parts all through the movie. It's a great film. It's very funny. It's exceptionally dated, including the soundtrack by Harold Faltermeyer, who was reacting to Herbie Hancock's Rocket at the time. And unfortunately, that movie made $11 gazillion at the box office and started a trend of everybody going, wait a minute, all we have to do is get some kid on a keyboard playing the music. And it started this horrible trend in the 1980s of instead of doing score, they would do these electronic keyboards. Yes.
Things like the video game themes at the time.
You can watch a lot of the movies at the time and realize, I'm not hearing score. I'm hearing some guy on a Casio. That's crazy. Well, that's Beverly Hills Cop, ladies and gentlemen.
Jesus.
Oh, and that's why I don't like Legend. The Tangerine Dream soundtrack just makes me want to claw my eyes out.
Oh God, Tangerine Dream soundtrack is beautiful.
Okay, well,
I gotta go with Aaron on that. I used to listen to that every night going
it's
to bed.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful.
You have not truly listened
John
to that
Anderson.
Soundtrack, Mark.
Oh,
if you think really, if you
I'm,
think that is
I'm
a
gonna,
piece,
I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna send you guys all of my Alan Parsons Projects albums while we're at it, and you guys can just go smoke pot, stare at your disco light, and turn on your black light.
I'm going to see Alan Parsons in August when they come in.
Nice.
I'll take it.
It is a beautiful piece of music. Say what you will about the movie. The music by Tangerine Dream was quite exceptional.
Right. I will agree to disagree. Okay. See, what the one thing I did like about Flash, Gordon, soundtrack by Queen. So there you go. See, it's okay if we're opposite on some of this. Number seven is Predator. What's great about Predator was the ad campaign for it. At the time, Schwarzenegger was the guy. This was from 1987. And by then, we'd had several Schwarzenegger movies. And so in the trailer, we see him kicking open the door and going, knock, knock. And you're like, oh, this is one of those movies where Arnold Schwarzenegger shoots a lot of people with guns. But they never – and it's a short trailer. They never tip off what the Predator is. And in fact, we're led to believe that Arnold Schwarzenegger is the Predator in the film. The whole movie is the setup for that. And so when it's revealed that it's in fact the Rastafarian from space that hunts the world's most dangerous game, which is basically what this is, a world's most dangerous game story, the tables are turned and the hunter becomes the hunted. And this was a great example, an early example of the bait and switch that we got in a lot of these movies in the 1980s. The ads would make it seem like one thing, and then you'd get there and you'd be like, no, it's something else. Oh, it's so cool. And a lot of people didn't always like that, okay? You have to remember, especially when it came to the endings, we were still conditioned to like the happy ending. We wanted things to work out. We wanted everything to be okay. And the 80s filmmakers, all of these movies that are now cult classics that bombed horribly and are now considered genius works of art, almost all of them tell the audience, no, it's not going to be okay. We're kind of screwed here. So it's true. And you know, Predator's another great example of one where, you know, nobody gets out. So number six.
Some people get out.
Yeah, in Predator, he actually survives.
Yeah, he survives, but at the cost of wiping the rest of the team.
And the girl.
And the girl survives. He probably died of, you know, cancer from radiation poisoning.
Right, some sort of weird alien radiation, yeah.
They took off They took off Jesse the Body Ventura's arm, for crying out loud. I mean,
well, come on. He was a sexual tyrannosaur.
He doesn't have time to bleed.
The Body Ventura.
That's true. He got no time to bleed. Number six, Silverado.
Ah,
yes. Written and directed by one of my all-time favorite screenwriters. And the same guy gave us Raiders of the Lost Ark and also helped out with Empire Strikes Back.
Go, Larry!
Yes, Lawrence Kasdan. This is not a Western. This is every Western. It is a tale of gunfighter redemption. It's an honest gambler trying to find a card game to play in. It's ranchers versus big industry. It's revenge. It's family. All of these themes intertwine, and there's even a little what's nice about it is it's got a progressive message in it that you do not find in a lot of films at this time. The message basically being Danny Glover kind of working as a Buffalo soldier in this capacity. The other thing that's really great about Silverado is the fact that it's got some eminently quotable lines. Kevin Kline has never been one of my favorite guys in the world, but Kevin Kline is genius in this film as Payton. He plays a wonderfully understated role. And this is another film that's not afraid to breathe in the dialogue. You see this a lot in the 1990s, starting with Reservoir Dogs, but this is one of the few movies where they actually have conversations about stuff, and it all speaks to character, and it matters. Mm-hmm. All-star cast, expertly shot, beautifully done, wonderful gunfights. If you're any kind of Western fan and you have not seen Silverado, shame on you. Rectify that now.
And it's responsible for bringing back the Western.
Top five. Number five, Ghostbusters. This movie is mythologized, and rightfully so. It's Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, and Dan Aykroyd at the top of their game. They just come off of Stripes, Caddyshack, The Blues Brothers. In fact, Dan Aykroyd's heavier in this because he's off the cocaine from The Blues Brothers. I just call it like I see him, folks. It's a wonderful story that, again, appears to be one thing and then kind of becomes something else.
I would also say he's probably heavier because he married Donna Dixon after Dr. Detroit, and she's a good cook.
Who could blame him?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, come on.
I can blame him for Dr. Detroit.
I love Dr. Detroit. Dr. Detroit is very 80s.
Very 80s.
So I think the whole franchise is basically buoyed by this. I don't think anything since then has been as good as the original movie. I think the second movie is half of a good movie, and the other half of it is product placement and sight gags that the studio felt that they need to put in there because they'd already started developing the animated series and all of the other ancillary tack-on stuff. This is an idea film that's a better idea in execution than in practice. In other words, you know, after you've got this one idea, you could go in a lot of different directions with it, but you can't go back to that well, you know.
Right.
Because what do you do after you've saved the city? In fact, the second movie starts with that letdown. It's shades of Son of Kong, but it's still kind of disappointing, you know, because I think part of the problem is that they should have never – that movie should have been a standalone. And then if you do a second Ghostbusters movie, you then move it to New Orleans where they actually are franchising the business.
Yeah.
And that idea, which everybody's trying to pathetically kick around right now, that idea should have been done back in 1987. This was just a case of it takes nothing away from the original film, which is really fun and is some classic Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd and Bill Murray. And, of course, eminently quotable all through the film, Rick Moranis. As Lewis Tully is just one of the all-time great schlubs. And most of his stuff was Rick coming up with it on his own. It's comedy gold.
Anyone want to play Parcheesi?
So number four, Lethal Weapon, Shane Black.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta have Lethal Weapon. Lethal Weapon.
Oh hell yeah!
Lethal Weapon is the start of the. Actually, Beverly Hills Cop kind of started the overblown cop drama, and did so in a you know, with some of these cliches that were carryovers from television. When Axel Foley's boss reads him the Riot Act. That, you know, the Lethal Weapon is playing with that tradition, but Shane was trying to plow new ground and come up with like a compelling reason for these guys to be together, and it works beautifully by having these guys have all this baggage that they don't want to deal with. I would say that you could actually watch the first three Lethal Weapon films and not feel cheated. I think they went one more than they should have.
Yeah.
But the first movie is has some wonderful bits in it as Mel Gibson plays the unhinged Riggs, who back in the day could have and should have been the model for Mike Baron's Badger comic. Really good martial artist in this regard. Murtaugh is great, Danny Glover, and they do a wonderful, their chemistry is what makes the film work. Mm-hmm. You know, that's pretty fucking thin. What the hell? Thin's my middle name. Let's go. You know, that's, there's some great lines in that, just all through it.
Yeah, I'm getting too old for this.
Oh, I'm getting too old for this, which has become now a hoary cliche, was invented for Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
Number three, I also put Big Trouble in Little China on my list because it is action adventure from the get go, and yes, it delves into mysticism and urban fantasy, but it starts in the real world. In fact, the real world is present all the way through it. Another eminently quotable film directed by the incomparable John Carpenter. And one of the all-time great 80s twists. This was originally envisioned as a Western, literally a Western. And through the writing process, it got moved into the modern day. And what's the thing that's most significant about it is that the hero and the sidekick, which is the holdover from the Western script, are flipped. Mm-hmm. Okay, the incompetent, bumbling sidekick role is assigned to Jack Burton, who is the hero, and the capable, strong-jawed, can do anything role is assigned to the bumbling sidekick, and it's such a simple little wink, but that little twist is what makes that movie absolutely brilliant from start to finish. Yep. You know.
Yep.
How'd you get up there, Egg? Wasn't easy.
That's it. There you go. I love the point. What's funny about this is as the further Jack descends into the underworld, he never quite believes it, but he stops questioning it, you know?
Right.
Egg, what's in that? What's in that? Magic potion? Yeah, good. Thought so. What are we going
to... Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that? No, don't tell me.
Yeah. You know, that's... there's a wonderful. I love the fact that he he's never in on the gag. Never, he never gets it. Not really, you know. One of the best things about that show is at the beginning. You know, when he's explaining all the stuff and he hangs up the phone. He's wearing the kimono, and he says, "This slow pan guy I ran over through." And then Uncle Chu cuts in and says, "Has spirit powers. His flesh and bones are atoms. He becomes a dream." And Burton's response is, "What?"
Yeah.
Huh?
Exactly.
It's 30 years old this week. You're gonna, and so it's everybody's talking about it online, but it is marvelous.
Yeah. I have to watch that again with Elena. I showed it to her a year ago or so, and she loved it.
Yeah. Number two, Die Hard.
Yeah.
Movie that made Bruce Willis a star.
Yep. I knew you had to mention Die Hard.
It's one of the great action films of all time. Bruce Willis has been dining out on this movie for the rest of his career, and it's true. His Don McClane role, John McClane, not Don McClane.
John McClane,
Don
yeah.
McClane did American Pie. Right.
His
John McClane role in this film is note perfect. He plays world weary. He plays tired. And of course, in the film, the joke is that it's jet lag. But no, you need somebody in that role. This plot that's so over the top with these European terrorists who have taken control of a Japanese owned corporation, which is another big 1980s thing, and his response to it is wrong place, wrong time. You know.
Yeah, and let's not forget that this also put Alan Rickman on the map too.
Yeah, it was a thing for Alan Rickman. There's a few other standouts, mostly character actors, but it's basically Bruce Willis's show to Spike, and he totally sticks the landing on it. It is wonderful. I actually, as the series went on, I became more forgiving because he got more world weary, and I find and the reason why I like world weary characters who have seen it all and done it all, and take a few hits before they figure out how they're going to defeat this guy, is the reason I put my film at number one, which is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Of course, I knew it. I was just waiting for that one. Come on,
Raiders of the Lost Ark is my Rosetta Stone. If you unpack that film, you will unpack about 85% of my personality, my likes, my dislikes, the things that I'm into, the stuff that I end up knowing a bunch of stuff about, the things that I write, the stories that I like to read. It's because it is such a love note to the cliffhanger serials, and Lawrence Kasdan's script has Humphrey Bogart in it, and Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones, being this world weary traveler who, you know, there's no mystical symbolism here. It's fortune and glory. You know, I'm doing this for myself. It's the museum gets it. My name goes under it. You know, under the plaque whenever I'm done. That's his deal. You know, he's this character is compelling from the get-go. One of the few really good characters that we meet fully grown that shows up with no explanation necessary and none given. And most of the fun of Indiana Jones comes in unraveling and figuring out from those little context clues what we know about him. And this film is dark. This is a dark postmodern film. It is grown men looking at cliffhangers and going, you know, what would we have done if we'd done this now? And there is no squeaky clean romance in this. There's actually a very sordid past that they downplayed for the actual final cut, but in the shooting script it's there. And there's a leftover line that if you're not careful, when you'll zip right through it in the 1980s, but you come back to it as in your 20s and go, hey, wait a second. When she says, I learned to hate you in the last 10 years, and he says, I never meant to hurt you. And she says, I was a child. I was in love. It was wrong, and you knew it. And his response to her is, you knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
And she says, now I do. This is my place. Get out. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't think I need to unpack that anymore for you guys. But this film is cynical. It's got a cynical dark edge to it, and the way it ends is one of those perfect examples of how we were hosed as kids in the 80s watching these films. They didn't turn the arc against the Nazis, which is what you would have done when you had that godlike power. The Nazis are evil. The Ark is good. You open the Ark, it eats the Nazis. Hey, I got an idea. Why don't we end World War II? No, we're going to pack it up and put it in warehouse, you know, whatever, so that nobody can ever find it again because it's too dangerous to mess with. They think they've done a good thing, and in fact, they didn't do anything. And so these films with these kind of cynical, hard-bitten endings, more than anything, really colored and influenced Generation X, I think.
Well, Raiders, too. I mean, Raiders showed you that if you have a character that is so active and fun that he can be that character through three-quarters of the movie, and that is the only circumstance, and everything else falls into place, under which we will accept a literal Deus Ex Machina ending.
Yes.
You know, that's it. That ending would not have worked if Indiana Jones had not done everything that we had just seen him do in the last 60 minutes.
Quick sidebar. You know, there's that theory going around that if Indiana Jones doesn't chase the Nazis, everything still happens the way it does. I disagree, and here's why. The reason why Belloc goes to the deserted island to check the Ark is because three times now Indiana Jones has managed to get his hands on it. He is literally the fly in the ointment. If you look at it from the point of view of Belloc has one goal: pull this thing out of the ground and take it to Germany. Well, the problem is that Jones found it first, and then he steals it from him in the truck, and then they managed to steal it back from him again. He steals it from the plane, then they steal it from the truck, then they steal it back. This whole time, it's been shifting back and forth and changing hands. And he knows that he can't kill Jones. he knows it. That's why they go to the deserted island. I'm on a submarine, I'm going to an island. There's no way he can find me to mess with this. But I have to check and make sure that I've got the real thing, because it would be just like him to take me to a false chamber and a false ark, because we know that there are separate chambers in there, and that the whole point of the map room is that you got to have the Staff of Ra to find it. So if that doesn't happen, the ark goes back to Germany, done and done. It's because Indiana Jones is that irritant for Belloc. That he says, and that's what the line is about. Are you sure, how would you feel coming to Berlin only to find that you don't have the true arc,
Right.
However, if they had brought it back to Berlin and opened it up for the Fuhrer, and it had done it there, the war would have been over.
Yeah, well, there is that part. There was a thing on Facebook that talked about, how did Indy know at the end? Why did he say, close your eyes, don't look at it? As it turns out, there was a part of the movie that got cut.
Yeah.
When they're talking to the scholar, yep, that Sala takes him to, and the scholar tells him that when the ark is opened, do not look at it. Close your eyes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that is why Indiana Jones says, close your eyes, Marion, don't look at it.
But it works.
Not because he suddenly got faith or anything like that, which some people have mistakenly
But it works on that level, though. Without that line, it still works.
It does.
To me, as a being raised Roman Catholic, the part that I sat in that movie theater and watched Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time in the movie theater, I was on the edge of my seat. I was terrified of the ark because John Williams' music, whenever that ark theme would play, the rat on the ship
reacting to the noise,
and the swastika is burned off the box, and I'm thinking, holy crap, and what Denham Elliott says is absolutely true. This is like nothing you've ever gone after before.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not even of this earth. I mean... This is nothing to be played around with. And I'm sitting there going, he's right. There's nothing to be played around with. Listen to that guy.
And that scene with the rat.
That
scene with the rat and the music and the swastika getting burned out.
Yeah,
the tone of that scene would not work in any other Indiana Jones movie. And that's one of the reasons why this is the best one.
It is.
The whole sequence of the Well of the Souls and going in, and when they pull it out and you see it in shadow. You see it coming out.
Yeah.
And Sala and Indy carrying it in that shadow of them moving it through. When Belloc takes the Ark to this little island, part of what he's obsessed with yet is to deliver it to the Fuhrer, but also because it is a radio for talking to God.
Right.
He sees it as bigger than just an archaeological piece, too.
Right.
He believes there's something more there, which is why he puts on a fucking ceremonial robe and he's got a staff and he's doing a whole
ceremony. Yeah, he won't just peek in.
He's not just opening it. He's doing a ceremony.
Yeah.
There's more to it than I want to be away from Jones, in my opinion. It's like, maybe he can control it for himself. Maybe these Nazis are all just tools and pawns for Belloc.
Well, and
power is before him.
Clearly they were. Belloc didn't care about the Nazis.
Oh, no.
But that's the thing, is that when Jones is talking about the Ark in the very beginning, he's explaining, and they're like, what's this ray? He's like, the power of God or something. I think even when the Ark is being opened, I don't think at that point Indy believes that the power of God is about to manifest.
Right.
And even in the end, when they're locking it up and they don't want to tell him where it is, he knows it has tremendous power.
Right.
Does he think it is the Ark of the God? No, he does not.
Yeah.
I think that's an important distinction, is that Indy is still cynical. He understands that what they have is something unprecedented. It must be studied. He has no idea what it is, but he's seen what it can do.
That's right. He doesn't have the faith. If you take that and go straight to Last Crusade, he's still not a person of faith.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It's not I don't think he has any kind of a sea change until the cup of Christ heals his dad.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There you can see it. There you can see the change. But when he's saying, Marion, close your eyes, don't look at it. He's like, I know the rules. I know the rules, the trick. And you don't look at this thing.
Right.
And then they open their eyes and all the Nazis are gone.
And
the
ropes,
like, wow, guess what?
And the ropes are burned away.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ropes are gone. I mean, there's so much there.
Yeah. So at the end, he wants it studied. What is this thing? What is this thing?
And the throwaway line in Last Crusade, too, when the Ark of the Covenant is depicted on the world. She says, what's that? And he says, it's the Ark of the Covenant. Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
Are you sure?
Yeah, pretty sure.
Well, gentlemen, Maximilian has given us the red eye.
Oh, hold on. I want to throw in really quick on the action movies, the ones that Mark covered, all the big ones.
Yes,
I really have very few to add, but I would add to that the movie of a smaller known, lesser known movie called FX.
Yes, oh, yes. Great one. Oh,
about a guy who uses basically special effects to trick a bunch of mobsters, and it's just wonderfully done. It was so refreshing when we saw it because I had never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
Here's a guy that's using his special effects to trick the bad guys.
Yeah.
Genius, and then
genius story.
And beautifully
cast. Wonderful. It's wonderful. It's one of my favorite action movies of the 80s. And then finally, very quickly, because it was our introduction to a lot of these Chinese actors, The Killer by John Woo.
Yes, yes. Sure, yeah.
What's another thing?
Far superior than the follow-up to that.
What was that called?
Hard-boiled.
Yes. Hard-boiled. So anyway, so those are my additions. Mickey, do you have anything? Or Joseph, do you have anything to add to the action? You got it all? Okay, Joseph, anything to add?
For action-adventure, I would... I don't know. You talked about Schwarzenegger a whole lot, and boy, I sure enjoyed him in the 80s. He certainly did a lot of fun stuff. I think Commando was pretty much way over the top and a lot of fun, though, but I enjoyed him in Commando. Yeah, no, I think you covered most of all the high points.
Yeah, I mean,
there
we got movies like Remo Williams and...
Yes, The Adventure Begins.
Yep. Oh, Year of the Dragon. Year of the Dragon was another really good action movie.
Yeah, Year of the Dragon.
All right.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this rather lengthy episode. Boy, Taylor, was a lot to talk about. I hope you were taking notes. I think we're going to put the list of these films on a site of some kind so you can check them out if you have not seen them. So from all of us here in the Lobot Lounge, thanks so much. Saying goodbye, we have Mark Finn.
Take care, folks.
Mickey Finn.
Arrivederci.
Aaron Dioriva.
Go see Legend of Tarzan, especially if you're a fan of pulp adventure or a fan of the character in any way. Go see it in the theater.
You're trying to get Greystoke in there?
No, I didn't mention Greystoke.
Oh, from the
list? No.
Yeah.
Start over.
No.
I did not mention Greystoke, but go see Legend of Tarzan. Anyway.
And I'm Joseph Patinos, reminding you once again that Red Skull lives. Good night, folks.
Gentlemen Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive. Promotional consideration by Mr. Fusion.
Mickey, you were going to bring up Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, nobody said Buckaroo Banzai.
It is a cult film.
It is.
But still, sci-fi.
I mean, as far as sci-fi movies of the 80s, maybe.
It's not a good
film. Along with Dune and Flash Gordon.
It's not a good
film. I mean, no, but if we're talking about cult classics,
that's
Buckaroo
true.
Banzai is up there with Flash Gordon and Dune.
It was on the
class.
List of 20, but it didn't make the final list.
Gotcha. Instead, what did you choose? Time Rider?
Yes. Oh, now.
Oh,
let's go. I saw it. I'm not proud of it.
I've never seen it.
I am not proud of it.
I had something on my list for sci-fi that I didn't mention was Space Hunter Adventures in the Forbidden Zone.
Oh,
Molly Ringwald.
Michael
Ironside is the overdog.
Oh, yeah. No, and none of you...
floating up there with his claws.
The overdog.
And
none of you mentioned Ice Pirates.
Pirates.
I'm thankful you didn't mention it.
No. Okay, to really, really explain this, Time Rider was on the list and accidentally didn't get erased. It was supposed to be replaced with The Fly. But as I'm reading this stuff, I'm like, oh, crap.
Somebody didn't edit my cue cards. I'm going to have to go with this. I'm going to have to say it. It's right there.
Now our fans are all going to go, oh, God, that Mickey guy liked Time Rider.
No, trust me, they're all going to go, what?
Yeah.
That's true. I'm familiar with the movie. I've just never seen it.
Gentlemen, I'm gonna dash. I have to go back and dress for this party, so we're off.
We'll have to think about a topic for our next Sunday podcast.
Sunday.
So you guys start thinking about that. We can brainstorm some ideas on Facebook.
Love stories for geeks.
What is it?
Love stories for geeks.
Oh, God, love stories for
Princess
geeks.
Princess Bride, Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah.
Maybe.
They exist. They're out there.
It's a thought.
Story.
All right.
All right, guys.
Bye.
Have fun.
Bye. 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 Bye.